This week, Havana erupted in celebration with the announcement of a new era of relations between Cuba and the United States. This hour, a conversation with an Iowan who's just returned from Cuba. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also today, protecting the homeless from frigid weather. We hear from a native of West Des Moines who's working in Ebola-stricken West Africa, and that the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics has been named the state's only Ebola treatment center. Also, tips for lowering stress levels at family gatherings this holiday season, and a simulator at Iowa State University to test how glaciers slide over their beds. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of our program. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about a high school lawsuit, a homeless shelter for the cold winter months. Also, we'll talk with a native of West Des Moines who is now working in Ebola-stricken West Africa. But we start off with this, with the news this week that the United States and Cuba will resume diplomatic relations for the first time in over 50 years. Many Americans will want to visit Cuba for the first time. But note, yes, the U.S. is indeed loosening travel restrictions to Cuba, but it's not yet officially allowing tourism. And in order to fully lift the embargo and permit all travel, Congress will have to get involved. Could be a long, messy fight if we know our Congresses from the past. Joining us now to give us, though, some firsthand perspective of Cuba, its people, and the government there. Mauro Heck is a native of Brazil. He's also called Iowa City his home for many years. Mauro just spent the past 3 weeks in Cuba and returned this past Tuesday. Mauro, welcome to our studio.
Hey, thanks, Ben. Great to be here.
Now, remind us, well, you were there to take part in a film festival.
That's right. I've been there for the film festival before and had a great time. I went there for the same reason, but I spent a lot more time biking, making friends with cyclists, and doing a lot of photography and lots of other things.
And because you're Brazilian, that allows you to visit Cuba more easily than the average American?
Well, Americans can go just as easy, and dozens and dozens of them are there coming every day. They go through Cancun or through Toronto or any place else.
You have to go through a third country.
Right, yeah. So it's a little silly. I mean, they've been going for many, many years.
Okay.
You run into them a lot. You also run into lots of Italians and French and Germans and so on.
Give us a sense of this country, its people, that American government has held at a distance for over half a century.
Well, it's an island, and island places like Ireland, that where I've been before, they have a unique way to be. They in some ways are weird, and they don't realize it. Like, they wear a scarf with a t-shirt. And, you know, it's not really cold outside. It's winter there now, but the weather is lovely, sunny, breezy. And the beauty of Havana, for instance, is that it's on a bike, you're not anywhere more than 5 minutes away from the ocean at all times. It is lovely. There's a long ocean shore that sort of surrounds in a horseshoe fashion the whole city, which is rather old. And the architecture is just amazing.
In fact, we're going to, you're a professional photographer. We're going to put some of your pictures, a link to them at least, on our website, iowapublicradio.org, and Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, to make sure you can see. You concentrated on doorways. Doorways are just beautiful, historical. That you found all kinds of doorways.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, some of those were built with technology from the 16, 1700s, and they're like 4 or 5 inches thick and 14 feet tall. And it's just amazing that they're still doing as well as they were 150 years ago.
Tell us, we hear anecdotes through the news, but how is business conducted in a society where essentially everyone is a government employee in communist Cuba?
Well, I have to say, I'm not an expert on Cuba. I've just been there a couple times. I have been to Latin America many, many other times. But Cuba is unique that, as we all know, it's a socialist communist government. So the government has their hands in most any large businesses, small business like mechanics, restaurants, and other smaller, you know, bakeries and that kind of stuff are independent. But if you're talking about a big hotel, a resort, or a bike shop even, you know, it's all government-owned and run. So it's a lot more complicated than we can have time to get into here, but there's a lot of bureaucracy there.
Mm-hmm. The church plays a huge role in people's lives.
Well, the church, amazingly, has never stopped existing, unlike, you know, people are criticizing Obama and the people who are pushing for this change. But if we look at China, for instance, Nixon went there in 72, I'm sorry. And still today, I mean, the Christians are not allowed to be, you know, Christians there. I brought this book, a biography of Don Bosco. Anybody who knows a little bit about Catholic Church know this great educator. And I bought it right at the church, and I went to church three times there, and they're thriving, remodeling, and people are coming, and so on.
It was Pope Francis who had a hand in the negotiations here as well.
Yeah, the guy's doing a few moves that are unexpected, and I'm glad that they got the two together.
I heard you brought a small suitcase of bicycle parts with you.
A suitcase and a half to Havana from here, from the bike library, and I also have to pitch an award for World of Bikes in the 30th Century, who kindly donated tools and lights and other things.
They don't have a lot of things, but bike parts they are in need of?
Oh, everything. I mean, everything. Clothes, shoes. It's amazing the number of people who ask me if they could have my shoes.
That off your feet?
Yes. If when I left, I could leave in my shoes, yes.
Mm.
Yeah, and I took a lot of clothes, too. So anything. The country is lacking. The country is poor. There's a lot of difficulties there. There's a lot of issues. Like, for instance, I connected some of the bikers that should have known each other for 5 years, and they don't. And I say, you guys need to organize. And they told me, well, that's not quite as easy as you think it might be.
So now I know you came back just before this announcement, if I'm
right.
Looking at the calendar right.
As I was coming, it was happening.
But tell us, what are the attitudes about everyday Cubans toward Americans?
Oh, they're most welcoming to anybody. They treat the government, the American government, as one thing and the American people as other, in part because they have no choice, in the sense that the tourism industry is by far the biggest industry they have. They have a lot of sugar cane, tobacco, and cigars, and rum, and so on. But tourism is what brings in the big bucks. Mm-hmm. So we got all kinds of Spanish, Italian, French, Canadian enterprises developing with golf courses, resorts, hotels. I mean, big, big things. Mm-hmm. But the Americans have so far been left out for obvious reasons.
Right. But 90 miles off the shores of Miami, and the floodgates of tourism may open very soon. Obviously, people will be thrilled to go to Cuba as tourists. What are your hopes and fears for the future as you see what may happen as this great opening happens?
Well, it's a great opening in some ways, but things are going to change slow, I hope, because any change that is too fast is not good. It has to be organic. And I'm sure that the government in Cuba is not going to allow for, you know, people are calling for overnight democracy. And that's just so utopian because, I mean, they've been doing the same thing there for 50 years. And to expect them to change overnight, you know, it's just not very smart, I think. So, you know, it's good that things will go slow. And I hope that's the way it goes.
Okay, Mauro Heck, wish we had more time. We'll have to have you back in the future. Mauro Heck, a native of Brazil, also an Iowan. He's called Iowa, and Iowa City is home for many years. Thanks for dropping into our studio, Mauro.
Thank you. Great to be here, Ben. Thanks.
And again, we want to make sure we'll post some pictures that Mauro took in his trip the past 3 weeks in Cuba. We'll get a link for those on iowapublicradio.org. Well, back here to the Midwest, where it's fairly cold, right? Colder than Havana, for sure. There are over 500,000 homeless people living in the United States. A third of the homeless have no shelter at all. And as our temperatures start to fall across the country, they represent a very vulnerable population. This week, the Iowa City Council voted unanimously to approve funding a temporary homeless shelter. It's at a vacant former Aldi's building. And the approval authorizes the city manager to spend some $20,000 up to that amount on the project to be open in the evening in through the morning, give a place to sleep,
for many people. And minimal accommodations will be provided in our Des Moines studio. Chrissy Canganelli, Executive Director of Shelter House in Iowa City. Hi, Chrissy.
Hi, Ben.
So this is an addition. Shelter House exists in Iowa City, and we've talked about that on this program before, providing shelter for individuals and families. Why did you submit this proposal on behalf of, I understand, the local homeless coordinating board for this extra temporary solution?
This was in response to concerns articulated by the Iowa City Police Department. Last winter, they had been providing emergent overnight shelter for individuals who could not or would not come into Shelter House. These are individuals who are living on the street or in encampments. They may be intoxicated. They don't want to come into Shelter House because of the rules, or they've been evicted in the past. So this was for a particular cohort of individuals. The police department had said that City Hall is not really appropriate to accommodate these individuals again, but they wanted to know if we could, as a community, come up with a solution in response to that need. And so through the spring and summer months and then into the fall, we had put together a plan, and it wasn't until Mike Hodge and Kevin Digman from Hodge Construction came forward and said, hey, we've got this commercial building available, it's vacant, we could work together, and they offered to make that facility available to us. And so that allowed us to really go forward quickly with putting the proposal together.
And the fear here is what? That the homeless who remain out in the elements wouldn't possibly freeze to death?
Well, they face freezing to death. And that's why the police department over the years has allowed, if not encouraged, people to come in. Last winter, because it was so severe, it wasn't just a night here and night there as it had been in the past. It was for a good part of the winter, and that's when they just felt overburdened and extended, yeah. Overextended. So
I recall, though there. I don't know if last year, but in years past, there have been actually people who have frozen under bridges and so forth.
There have been, and I want to just throw a word out there of caution that in making this resource available, we can't necessarily prevent that from happening again in the future because we cannot demand that people come in. Some of these individuals are fiercely independent. All we can do is say that we'll remove the barriers that exist right now for these individuals to access the services. So there's no requirements. People can come in. They can be intoxicated at the point that they're coming in. We're not having any program rules or requirements that they're addressing their situation. So low minimum barriers coming in, ensuring that we're able to staff and provide a safe, warm place for them to sleep. And that's the intention, is to help prevent people from freezing to death or exposure to frostbite. Last winter, someone experienced burns over 70% of their body because they were trying to keep warm in their tent and set fire to themselves in their tent. So really to avoid those types of situations, those tragedies from happening.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Shelter House is a different animal. It has more rules to attach. This is a much sort of more streamlined operation just to get people out of the weather. Shelter House wouldn't require people with substance abuse problems to continue that, would they?
I'm not sure that I understand
question. Well, just the difference between Shelter House and this new shelter.
I can speak to that. Yep. At Shelter House, we breathalyze every night. We do require that people are maintaining their sobriety, that they're working on those programs and plans with respect to that, that they're working with us to find employment, maintain employment, address their health issues, their mental health issues, all of these things. It's a very comprehensive wraparound intended scope of services that we offer and then at the same time require of people to work with us to address those issues. So this program, it's just going to run. It's a pilot project, January and February only, and just to address those needs of people who are otherwise out on the street and service resistant.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand a few dozen signatures have been gathered from local businesses.
Yeah.
This is in a commercial district in Iowa City, businesses surrounding it, no homes. But these people, local business people, are petitioning the City Council of Iowa City to not fund or participate or do anything to support this additional shelter and to support anything that's outside of what is the main Shelter House. And what is your reaction to that?
I understand that they're concerned and they're worried about this increase intensive use in the neighborhood. We all fear what we don't know or change. And I would just encourage them to look at the experience that we've been able to and the demonstration that we have shown in our existence in the neighborhood as it is. We've worked in that neighborhood since the winter of 2010. We have not seen the original fears that were articulated by the businesses. They've gone unrealized. So these concerns of increased vandalism, criminal activity, and all these things, that has simply not happened. They have not been manifested. So I would ask them to have faith in us that we will work with the Iowa City Police Department and ensure that we are not only meeting the health and safety needs of the individuals that we're serving, but that we feel very responsible for, as much as we can, ensuring the health and safety and well-being of the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
These individuals are coming in 5 o'clock in the evening. They'll be leaving at 8 o'clock in the morning. There's no reason for them to be, quote unquote, hanging around in the neighborhood. And that's something that the businesses are concerned. They're also concerned about increased acts of violence or vandalism. Quite frankly, leaving people out on the street to fend for themselves. They'll seek shelter in individual business areas and alleys as it is. There's an increase of vandalism that's directly demonstrated by allowing people to shelter themselves outdoors, as opposed to providing a safe, staffed location for them to come in. You'll actually see vandalism, criminal activity, acts of desperation decrease. Other communities have seen that and mm-hmm. reported it.
In the minute or so we have left, Chrissy, tell us, later in the program we're going to be talking about dealing with the stress of getting together with family during the holidays, but this is a much different scale. Help us imagine the stress of a homeless person, especially at this time of year.
It's difficult. I can't speak to that. I witness the impact of homelessness every day in my work at Shelter House. But the trigger points and the different seasons and holidays affect people differently. Sometimes people are overcompensating, but it's difficult to talk about the celebration and joy that this time of year is to represent and symbolize for most of us. All I can say is it's a fundamentally different experience for people who don't know where they're going to be the next night or who have lost everything. They've come to us at this time of year and are really trying to just figure out how to put their lives back together. Their mindset and their construct, it's an entirely different approach to their day and to the what's in front of them. I'm not clearly articulating.
No, very good. Chrissy Canganelli, we have to go. Executive Director of Shelter House, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. A programming note, next week at time, no NewsBuzz because of the holidays. Garrison Keillor once said this, "The lovely thing about Christmas is that it's compulsory, like a thunderstorm, and we all go through it together." Well, perhaps you're someone who experiences the holidays as especially stressful, or perhaps you tend to get the blues during this season of merrymaking. If so, we want to provide some tips right now from Michael O'Hara. He's a professor of psychology and the Starch Faculty Fellow at the University of Iowa. Michael, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You're heading off into the holidays, too?
I am. My wife and I are probably shortly after this interview, we're going to be driving to Indianapolis, where we'll meet one of our children, and then head on to one of my sister's for our annual holiday gathering. So this is, I'm going to listen to my own advice here and try to take it.
First of all, before we get to the advice, what are the causes of stress when we get together with loved ones, with family members?
Well, I think there's several things that often happen. One is that in some families, there's not good communication among family members. There might be conflict, and sometimes the history of these comes back to families at these holiday times when there's an expectation that everybody's going to get together and have a good time. And so that's part of it, is that it's just a time when people are together, and sometimes they don't want to be together. On the other hand, sometimes there's the case where Family members have very high expectations about this being a very positive time, and everyone is going to get along. And sometimes those expectations are violated, and the anticipation there can be a problem.
Okay, so what are some good tips for us? What's some advice?
Well, I think that there are several things that I might suggest. Is that one is simply to try to is to plan a little bit about, you know, if you're visiting family, how all of that's going to go, where you're going to stay, how you're going to manage problems that you know are likely to occur. So being prepared is one thing. I always suggest to individuals that you really want to watch your diet during the holidays and at family gatherings, since there's always that temptation to overeat, and then you start not to feel very good and feel remorseful. Watch your alcohol intake. Sometimes conflict is fueled by alcohol, so that's something to have realistic expectations and understand that things don't always go the way you expect them to go, and to really identify what your support systems are. And sometimes for women who are hosting gatherings is to make sure that, you know, they don't take on all of the responsibility themselves, but to ask for help. And sharing, I think, is probably one of the major things in supporting each other. You know, we all have a responsibility to contribute to kind of the positive features of a holiday gathering, even if we don't feel like it. So it's important to be a good host and a good guest.
I like that what you said about making a plan. I think many of us do that. We have family gatherings, and again, maybe it's the only time of the year we get together with certain family members, and then on the drive there or the flight there, you recall, oh, this went off the rails during that last family gathering, and you might have your spouse with you. You can say, let's avoid that and make sure, what, we just stop arguments before they start?
Well, I think many of us know, or perhaps most of us know, what our trigger points are, so to speak. And so if we, you know, are a little bit careful this time of the year and not say or do things that are likely to trigger conflict both for others and for ourselves, it probably helps things to go a little bit more smoothly.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned diet, exercise going along with that too, right?
Yes, and I think, again, this sort of gets back to the idea that you want to maintain as much of a routine as you can, and exercise is very important. And often it's neglected, particularly for individuals who are traveling. So to get out and you know, have a walk, and this can be a very positive time to just be out walking with friends or relatives. And also, by the way, doing things for other people. You know, there's many opportunities this time of the year to help out and volunteer, and so sometimes looking out after others, focusing on others rather than ourselves, can be actually a very, very positive event. And, you know, getting enough rest and getting good night's sleep, and this all kind of ties into staying healthy during the holidays, not just when company is coming, but just more generally across that period of time.
Michael O'Hara, professor of psychology at the University of Iowa, thank you for these tips. We'll let you get on your way to Indianapolis to that family gathering. I wish you a healthy holiday season and a low-stress family gathering, Michael.
Well, thank you very much, Ben, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts about this time of the year.
I'm Ben Kiefer, and we'll be back in just a moment with more of our NewsBuzz edition of River to River. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Friday NewsBuzz edition of our program. We like to talk with people of about a half dozen topics we're jumping around to this hour. The University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics has been named as the state's only Ebola treatment center. We'll hear about that in just a minute. But first, let's go to West Africa. Nearly 18,000 Ebola cases have been tallied to date, mostly in West African countries in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. More than 6,300 patients have died, And Sierra Leone surpassed Liberia earlier this month as the hardest hit, with more than 8,000 cases. Let's get another perspective on the Ebola outbreak in West Africa with a native of West Des Moines who is now in Sierra Leone, in the capital of Freetown. Nina Weisenhorn is with us, Senior Education Coordinator for the International Rescue Committee via Skype. Nina has spent the past 7 years with the International Rescue Committee, but only since November, I understand, Nina, in Freetown. Can you hear us?
Yep, that's right. I'm here in Freetown.
Okay. You arrived back in November. What were your first impressions concerning this crisis? And we want to mention here, you've worked in many crisis areas around the world. What were your first impressions?
Yeah. So when I first arrived here in Sierra Leone, you can definitely tell the country is still in crisis mode. And even in the capital, over the last couple of weeks, they've really been ramping up their efforts to fight Ebola. And as you said, opening the program, the number of cases of Ebola here in country is on the rise. And the government, communities, and partners, including the International Rescue Committee, continue to increase our efforts to stop the spread of Ebola and care for patients here.
Mm-hmm. So as Senior Education Coordinator, what have been your tasks?
So as a member of IRC's emergency response team, I focus on how we are responding to children, and specifically looking at how we ensure that children are receiving education even during the time of crisis. So specifically, IRC is supporting the government to provide continued alternative learning opportunities for children. In the districts that we work with teachers who are both on the payroll and community teachers to help them check out books from the school libraries and bring those books to children's homes. They also sit with the children in their homes and read with children, and they help children read to each other. And then we're also helping teachers to organize small study groups where children can listen to the Ministry of Education's emergency radio education program, respond to their questions, and help them understand the lessons that are being broadcast across the national radio network here. And then we also, IRC has a whole group of scholarship beneficiaries. We've been funding girls to attend junior secondary schools here in Sierra Leone. And with schools being closed, we have been conducting a tracer study to identify what has happened to the girls, how has the outbreak affected their lives, and how many girls have hopes of returning to school.
Nina, before going to Sierra Leone, you were deployed in other areas. You just returned from northern Iraq, before that Togo. How does this compare?
Coming to Freetown reminded me a lot of Togo, of course, being another West African country, and also reminded me of the 5 years I spent working on education in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The challenges are unique because schools are actually closed and there are limited alternative opportunities for education for children. But the challenges that they face and the risks they face being out of school are very similar to other countries in the region, including the risk of teenage pregnancy, the risk of early marriage, the young boys and young girls being engaged in child labor, and the risk that they may not return to education. Speaking with one young boy when I was out visiting our program, he was explaining how while schools are closed, he's been driving a motorcycle taxi, and he's slowly making money. And he, when I asked him whether or not he would return to school, he said, if money's good, why should I return back to school? And, it's a typical adolescent response. I remember, summer jobs when I was a kid. And of course you have that thought while you're out of school, if I'm making what I need, why should I go back to school? And the return and reopening of school is going to be a huge challenge here.
And finally, Nina, before we let you go,
Tell us, not all natives of West Des Moines go on to help in crises around the world with education. When did you decide that you were suited for this sort of global humanitarian work?
Yeah, well, growing up in Iowa and the education and upbringing that I received from my parents really opened up my worldview. And we traveled as kids, and that was very much a part of my education. And it was really as I graduated college that I had made the decision to join the Peace Corps and became a volunteer in Togo. And it was through that experience that I decided that this was the kind of work that I wanted to do. And I returned back to the U.S. and got my master's degree in international educational development and have been working with the International Rescue Committee ever since.
Okay. Nina Weisenhorn of West Des Moines now talking with us via Skype from Sierra Leone. Thank you very much, and good luck with the very important work that you're doing. Thank you for the update.
Great. Thanks so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also, Ebola news this week from here in Iowa. The University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City announced this week that the state's Comprehensive Academic Medical Center has been named Iowa's only Ebola treatment center. Joining us now to talk a little bit about that designation, Dr. Laureen Herwalt, the Director of Hospital Epidemiology at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Herwalt, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So to be clear, we've heard in our news Iowa is not one of the 35 national Ebola centers designated by the U.S. This is not what this is?
Well, that's because the CDC has a limited number of people who are able to go and inspect hospitals and help them be prepared and basically say, yes, we think you are ready. So, and what they've done is they've prioritized based on states that have West African populations and the states that have the five airports that are doing the screening.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
we haven't been inspected yet by CDC. We're anticipating that we will be, or hoping that we will be, possibly sometime in January.
What does this mean for the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics? What does it entail in terms of resources, training?
What does the CDC or
what does this designation as Iowa's only Ebola treatment center mean for changing of operations or training there?
Well, it doesn't mean that we get any additional resources. It just means that we've been willing to care for patients who have Ebola infection. And so we have been preparing since the middle of August for that possibility. And it was just this last week that the state announced that we would be willing to care for those patients and that several other hospitals would be willing to care for patients when we're trying to rule in or rule out the diagnosis of Ebola.
Okay, so does that mean what would be the UI hospital's catchment area, if I can put that out? Anybody suspected possibly of having Ebola in Iowa, or is it wider than that?
Probably mostly the state of Iowa, although some patients or people in far western Iowa might, go to Nebraska, and that would depend on the negotiations between the state health departments. Possibly we might get some people from western Illinois, but probably mostly Iowa.
Mm-hmm. How you mentioned preparation. What sort of preparation going on at the hospital?
We've done a lot of training of a core team of people for how to get in and out of the personal protective equipment. We've identified the unit where the patients would be housed and assessed the resources needed in those areas. We have worked out protocols for things like how we would get specimens to the lab, what kinds of specimens we would get. We've worked out care protocols for patients, worked out major screening protocols so that every patient who is seen in one of our clinics or our emergency department or admitted to the hospital is screened for travel to the four affected West African countries built that into our electronic medical record so that, you know, we don't wouldn't miss anybody. And we've worked extensively with the State Department of Public Health to build communication with them and with hospitals around the state. And then today we're actually doing a training workshop for EMS providers who would bring patients to us or potentially to other hospitals in the state.
Of course, it was this summer and early in the fall that we had the big panic over Ebola in the U.S. and some diagnosed Ebola cases here in the U.S. Do you know what the state of that is right now? Do we have any people diagnosed with Ebola in the U.S.?
To my knowledge, no. And we definitely do not have any in Iowa right now. We don't have anybody who's being tested for Ebola. We have only one patient who's felt to be at very, or not patient, person, who's felt to be at very low risk of acquiring Ebola, who's being monitored by the State Department of Health right now.
Mm-hmm. How many Ebola patients could the center, treatment center at the UI hospitals hold?
We could take care of two patients, given the space that we have in the intensive care unit where we would care for them. We need a lot of space particularly for taking off the personal protective equipment so that people can do it safely. The area where we plan to do it actually has four patient care rooms. We would dedicate two of those for caring for patients and two for the areas where people would come out of the patient room and take off their personal protective equipment in a safe environment.
There's been some criticism in the media that the risk of an Ebola outbreak in North America was overhyped in the media. As an epidemiologist, do you feel that?
I think that the risk of an Ebola outbreak in the U.S. is very, very low. What we've seen so far, number one, is we haven't had that many patients even arrive in the U.S. Most of them have been intentionally brought here for care. In the incident in Dallas, we had two nurses who became infected, but they became infected when they were caring for the patient at the very end of his life, and they did not have adequate personal protective equipment, and there was no spread from those nurses. I think now with the level of awareness and preparedness that our hospitals have in the U.S., and the level of personal protective equipment that they have, that and also the screening that is being done as people come into the country, I think the chance of an outbreak here is very, very small.
I was reading a Reuters report where they talked with health IT companies and industry experts, and the point of the article was to say that this Ebola outbreak has accelerated changes in how U.S. hospitals address the threat of infectious diseases. Do you agree with that? Would you say that's true of the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, that it's has benefits wider than the threat of Ebola?
I think we don't know at this point how broadly we'll be able to apply specific things that we have done for Ebola. I do think that quite a number of the things that we have done will help us a lot, and that's will be one of the things we'll be trying to sort out in the next few months of, you know, how can we really integrate this into our overall preparedness? Because Ebola is spread differently than things like influenza, which potentially could cause a pandemic, you know, we can't just use exactly the same things that we do for Ebola to make sure we're ready for pandemic flu. But I think we will find some lessons, and some of the infrastructure that we've built will be very helpful in dealing with possible events in the future. It certainly helped us build communication and screening systems in our hospital, and communication with the health department and with other important entities in the state.
Dr. Lorene Herwalt, thank you very much. Director of the Program of Hospital Epidemiology at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics this week UI hospitals being declared Iowa's only Ebola treatment center. Thank you for filling us in on that, Dr. Herwalt.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Finishing up this hour, a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's go to this. So scientific research about glaciers being done, though, here in Iowa. Haven't had glaciers in this part of the continent, certainly in living memory. Just kidding. It would be quite a memory you would have to remember when glaciers were in this part of the continent. There's some research, though, being done at Iowa State University. It published in the Journal of, I think I'm going to have my guest help me with how to pronounce this. Lucas Zoot is with us. He's in our Des Moines studio, postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at Iowa State University, involved in some new research on glacial beds sliding at high speeds. What's the name of the journal you were just published in?
Yeah, it's called the Journal of Glaciology.
Glaciology. Okay,
yep.
Good. Lucas, welcome to our program. Tell us what you're up to there at Iowa State University.
Well, at Iowa State, we have sort of a unique laboratory set up there where we can study different aspects of the glacier. And specifically, what we're focused on is understanding how the glacier slides or move over its bed. And what we do is we have a big ring of ice that's about 3 feet in diameter, and it's about 10 inches thick, and it slides, or we rotate it over a bed that's fixed. And as it's rotating, we measure all sorts of different things about it. And what we're trying to determine is come up with physical relationships between the ice and the bed and how it responds at different sliding speeds.
Mm-hmm. What is it? What is the bed below a glacier made of? Is that just the ground?
Yeah, it's just it can be composed of either like crystalline or hard rock, or it can be composed of sort of loose sediment or till, sort of like we see all around Iowa all over the place.
Okay, so glaciers, and if we would have talked about years ago during the last ice age in North America, that would have been the same sliding action that would have brought glaciers to Iowa?
Yep, the exact same processes that were going on over in the last ice age exist, you know, in current glaciers, so we can study them there, and we can apply them to sort of these ice sheets and glaciers from the past ice age to understand how glaciers are moving now, and we can understand how glaciers are going to move in the future.
Why is this especially important in a time of receding glaciers in around the world and also a time of concerns over global climate change?
Well, to be able to accurately predict what's going to happen in the future, one of the most important things is to understand how this glacier is sliding. And so there's very, you know, fundamental physics in place here, but to understand what track the glaciers are going to end up taking in the future, you know, to basically minimize those error bars and what's going to happen, we have to understand this relationship very accurately.
Mm-hmm. We always use the expression moving at a glacial pace.
Yeah.
How fast do glaciers move? Are there different ones? Are there speedy ones and slow ones?
Oh, yeah, definitely. They can basically vary over a wide range of speeds, as slow as, you know, just a meter or two a year, up to, you know, 10 kilometers per year in some areas. And that's all because of different mechanics that are going on at the bottom. Most people think of glaciers moving along as it's, you know, maybe it's deforming over time. But in actuality, those ones that are moving very fast, is while they're all deforming, most of the motion is actually coming from the glacier just moving over its bed.
Mm-hmm. So you have this big platter of ice that you're studying there.
Yep.
Do you want to get to a glacier and sort of check out your results with the real deal?
Well, I've been to a lot of glaciers, and there's a lot of sort of field work that's been done, but in the field of glaciology, what's really lacking is these experimental results. So I'm actually more excited about coming back into the lab and trying to understand these small processes, because when you go into the field, you know, there's a lot of factors going on, there's a lot of things going on, and it's hard to sort of separate the good data from just the noise in the background. And in the lab, we're able to do that. And at Iowa State, this is the only instrument like this in the world. So we're basically the only people that can study these things because we have the only machine that can do it.
Is ice, or does that also, the type of ice, determine the speed of the sliding?
The type of ice can have an important role in how the ice deforms and how it moves over sort of small bumps at the bed. And so while glacial ice has a very distinctive sort of fabric or texture to it, opposed to sort of ice you would just make in your freezer, we can actually we can actually make ice in this machine that looks just like the ice that you'd find, say, at the bottom of Antarctica by just shearing it, which is just basically displacing it for a long enough time. Those patterns were developed so that it'll look and behave just like ice that's in Antarctica or Greenland or something.
Okay, Lucas Zoot is a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at Iowa State University. Thanks for joining us to tell us about the scientific research being done on glaciers and their sliding here in Iowa at Iowa State University. Thanks, Lucas.
Well, thanks for having me.
Coming up on Monday, we'll reach back and listen back to a program that we did some time ago here on River to River. Humans evolved in tropical and savanna regions, but eventually made their way into more climatically variable parts of the world, including some really cold and challenging places, Iowa, for example. Next time, on Monday, we'll learn how our ancestors developed various physiological traits that enabled us to survive the coldest of the cold and the hottest places on Earth. That's on Monday on this program as we get into the Christmas week. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.